I think I can remember one of the last times that Harry Larson was with us. One of the things that he encouraged us to do is when we read the Word of God, we need to use our imagination. And in that sense, our imagination is not about fantasy or that which is not true, but in some ways, we need our imagination to understand the story behind the words. When we stop and think about it, some things we read in the scriptures can be a little confusing to us. If we just take the words on the page at face value, we can and we usually will miss the story that's there. By the way, in honor of Georgia, a story, I'm not talking about things that are not true, that you told stories to people, but the story is the story of our lives, of how we have lived. And so it's also true in the scripture that this is the God with us story. It's how God revealed himself over time with people in different places. I know that we know that even life in the scriptures are at least three-dimensional. You know, height, width, depth. I suppose that's why we enjoy the movies about stories so much that it includes what we would only enter into through our imagination if we just read the words on the page. So today, I want to color in the picture that's here. So let's read the account first, okay? We just heard it, Matthew 11, 2 through 11. Now, when John heard in prison about the deeds of Christ, he sent word by his disciples and said to him, "Are you the one who is to come, or shall we look for another?" And Jesus answered them. Okay? These are the words from the disciple, John's disciples. Jesus says, "Go and tell John what you hear and see. The blind receive sight, and the lame walk. Lepers are cleansed, and the deaf hear. And the dead are raised up, and the poor have good news preached to them. And blessed," hear this verse, "and blessed is the one who is not offended by me." As they went away, Jesus began to speak to the crowds concerning John. "What did you go out into the wilderness to see? A reed shaken by the wind? What then did you go out to see? A man dressed in soft clothing? Behold, those who wear soft clothing are in king's houses. What then did you go out to see? A prophet? Yes, I tell you, and more than a prophet. This is he of whom it is written, 'Behold, I send my messenger before your face, who will prepare your way before you.' Truly I say to you, among those born of women there has arisen no one greater than John the Baptist, yet the one who is least in the kingdom of heaven is greater than he." Okay, that's a familiar passage to us, isn't it? But think about what's there, okay? What do we know about John? Well, let's start with his father. You know, remember him, Zechariah? And then to his mother. You see, Zechariah, he was a priest and a Levite for the nation. Okay, so in that sense, not royal, but priestly bloodlines. We remember his story when it came his turn to offer the annual sacrifice for the nation's sins in the Holy of Holies. Remember that he and Elizabeth had been without child. And in that culture, being without child, it made your marriage a failure in a way, a social failure. But an angel of the Lord had promised them a son whose name would be John. Remember the big deal about John? John's not a family name. We name our children in accordance with family. Then the story after that picks up with Elizabeth, pregnant with John, living in the hill country. And then after that, the next encounter is with Mary, Elizabeth's young cousin, in the midst of Mary's own pregnancy with Jesus. Remember that at the greeting of Mary that John responded interuterine, if you will? You know, he leapt in his mother's womb. Now, growing up as his cousin, John and Jesus, don't you think that John and Jesus knew each other? At least they knew of each other. They did not have to use Ancestry.com to figure out who they were. It was pretty clear. From the same maternal family. The story continues with John's prophetic work in the desert. John is clear about who he is and who he is not. I'm the forerunner. I am the one who announces the way. I am the one who prepares the way. Okay? So as John does this work, he's sent by God into the desert from which he does the work that he's given. This is, if you will, his platform. This is the platform of his life. This is the environment from which he does what God calls him to do. He's given the message of repentance to prepare people for Jesus' work of redemption. Can you imagine this in extended family conversations about eccentric John? I think people were more taken with John in the family than with Jesus, who was at home faithfully carrying out his father's profession as a carpenter, taking care of his mother after his father is gone. And then there's this weird John. John is quite clear about the Messiah. And Jesus knows about it. He knows about what John knows. And he eventually catches John at the Jordan River for his own baptism. The encounter there in the Gospel of John 3:22 tells us that John knows who Jesus is. Remember what he said? He said, you should be baptizing me, not me, you. If you remember when, at that time, the voice from heaven said, this is my son in whom I am well pleased. But John was there. And just maybe he heard the same voice. Can we say that just maybe John knew who Jesus was? So Jesus follows up the examination by John's disciples with a powerful statement as to who John is in God's economy of things. It's easy to put John in the margins of the Advent story, but in fact, he is illustrative of God's ways. In fact, the gospel readings that we've had this year all have to do with John. Because he's viewed as a desert creation, eccentric, and ultimately powerless now in prison, Jesus places him center stage. The beauty of John is that he simply did what the Father called him to do. He simply did that which the Father called him to do. Nothing more, nothing less. And by the way, we have the same honor by simply following what Jesus shows us to do. If you will, with John, it was a calling. It was not a career. He called him to follow him. So based on what I've already said of John and his connection to Jesus, it's my guess that John's concern is that since he's not likely to leave prison alive, it's important that his disciples see Jesus for who Jesus is. The allegiance of John's disciples would need to be moved from him to Jesus. So the account of the Apostle John in John chapter 3 is important background to John the Baptist's concern. So let me draw your attention to John chapter 3, verse 22. I'm going to read a little bit of this. You know, again, this might be something that you know, but it's easy to forget these things. John 3, starting with verse 22. After this, Jesus and his disciples went into the Judea countryside, and he remained there with them and was baptizing. John also was baptizing at Aenon near Salim, because water was plentiful there and people were coming and being baptized, for John had not yet been put in prison. Now a discussion arose between some of John's disciples and a Jew over purification. And they came to John and said to him, "Rabbi, he who was with you across the Jordan, Jesus, whom you bore witness to, look, he's baptizing and all are going to him." We just assume competition, don't we? John answered, "A person cannot receive even one thing unless he is given to him from heaven. You yourselves bear me witness that I said, I am not the Christ, but I have been sent before him. The one who has the bride is the bridegroom. The friend of the bridegroom who stands and hears him rejoices greatly at the bridegroom's voice. Therefore, this joy of mine is now complete. He must increase, I must decrease." So John knows him and knows about him. Right? So it makes some sense that confirming the authority of Jesus would be essential to John's disciples, if indeed John's role is completed. And we've learned in a few more verses, it has. It is complete. It's a matter of transferring allegiances from John's disciples to Jesus. So if that's the case, it's not that John doesn't know who Jesus is, but his disciples need confirmation. Okay? So when you think of the story, and we looked at those verses on the page, initially you think, oh, John doesn't know who Jesus is. Well, yes, he does. But there's another purpose that's going on here. So what does John's story tell us about God's ways? Well, I think, first of all, John was faithful to a calling, not a career. We live in a world that is all about a career. It never was. It never was before modern man. It was about a calling. What's the person I'm called to be? Where this calling took John, it took him to an invisible place, the desert. He's not a city boy. They had to go out to the desert to encounter him, and then from the desert to the prison. To the prison. In our world, we would say, how unsuccessful is he? So if your earthly destiny is prison, how rewarding is that? The truth is, one would have to value obedience above notoriety or comfort. One would have to value obedience to God above notoriety or comfort. Second, like John, the work that we do is both our opportunity to shed the light of Christ and an opportunity to be shaped and formed into the image of Christ. I do what I do in order to be shaped and formed in the image of Christ. Remember what Paul says, Romans 8:29? For you have been predestined to be conformed to the image of Christ. That's what I'm here for, is to be conformed to the image of Christ. Thirdly, the eccentric nobody ensconced in the wilderness of Judea was right where he was supposed to be. Way too often we think it's about a place. Or we think it's about a job. But it's about a being. Where I am. Being where I am. Reminds me of the title of a book I read a few years ago. It's a wonderful book. The guy's name is a three-part name. I can't remember, but his last part is Wilson's last name. But anyway, the name of the book is The Wisdom of Stability. The Wisdom of Stability. Now, in his book, what he's talking about is a Jonathan something Wilson, Hargrove Wilson, lives in Raleigh, North Carolina, and he and a group of friends moved into a rundown area of Raleigh to be the light of Christ there, and they're committed for the rest of their lives to be there, to be present. You know, frankly, when Norma yesterday was at His Life Fellowship, it's the wisdom of stability. That community, that faith community, is about the wisdom of stability in an area of our city that desperately needs stability. So many of those people who are from Hispanic backgrounds, when they become financially more stable, they move out. But the whole point was, is that no, stay there. Be the light of Christ where you are. That would be true for any of us anywhere we live. Be the light of Christ where you are. So beyond the history of the story here, there is ample meaning. Confirming who Jesus was and is remains important in every generation. If I ask, I should do that. If I ask the people that I pick up in a week, say 15, 20 writers, and some of them are multiple, but you know, different writers, and I said, "Who is Jesus?" I know I would get all kinds of crazy answers because people don't know. They don't know who Jesus is. They don't know who Jesus was. This is kind of an aside, but it's a little game I play. Because on my CD player, I have right now I happen to have John Denver. Okay, so they listen to this, and I'll say, "So, have you ever heard this singer before? Have you ever heard this song?" "Yeah, kind of. I think so." "So who is he?" "I don't know." I said, "Well, he's John Denver." And they go, "Huh. Never heard of him." Or another one is Peter, Paul, and Mary. So, "Do you know who's singing this song?" "No, I don't think I've ever heard that song." "Well, have you ever heard of Peter, Paul, and Mary?" "Well, no, I've never heard." You know how quickly we lose any notion of things that have happened in the past before our lifetime, if you will. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So confirming who Jesus is remains important in every generation. In fact, I kind of think maybe I'm gonna ask God to show me how to ask that question to my grandsons in a couple weeks. "Do you know who Jesus is?" I think they do, but we'll see. So no less in our generation, because all the noise, we can lose sight of the meaning of Advent. See, most of the people that I give rights to, "Advent, what are you talking about? Never heard of it." So most conversations I have with strangers on the street, Christmas is about family for ill or for good. I gave a ride to a lady yesterday. Her family's from California. And she says, I said, "So how's it families getting together?" She says, "Oh, they just complain. Every time they come, they complain about how cold it is. And then they complain. And it's like, you know, sometimes when people get together as family, it's not a good idea." Jesus and the incarnation in our world is nowhere to be found. So there's always the need to prove the truth of Christ. The truth about Christ is always hard for modern man to accept. Yes, they'll sing Christmas carols about the truth without ever believing anything that they're singing. Yeah, even what we sang, "Joy to the world, the Lord has come." Did they have any idea? The truth about Christ challenges the perceptions most common among us. That is, being the literal Son of God is a stretch for most of them. Somehow the babe in the manger is really all the rest of the story. Interestingly, Jesus ends the discussion of what he does with the statement, "And blessed is the one who is not offended by me." The offense that Jesus speaks of here is the truth about him, that he is the way, the truth, and the life. And no one comes to the Father except through him. No one comes to heaven except through him. We know in our culture today that that's offensive. And I hear people telling me that I'm offended about this or that. I'm just like, what are you talking about? Everybody is offended about something. Simply stated, the Christian faith is offensive in our world. And there is a day coming soon, I think, when the Christian gospel is seen as hate language. Even what we're saying here today is hatred. It's hate language. By saying that there's only one way. That's hate language. So we best get used to it. When Jesus taught in his day, what Jesus taught in his day was offensive in his day. And his word was even more religious than ours. Yet we best be prepared to not be popular. What then do we know? The Christian message of hope, peace, joy, and love coming through Jesus remains central to a true Christmas celebration. The Christmas message of hope, peace, joy, and love coming through Jesus alone remains central to a true Christmas celebration. The Advent Christmas story is never outdated. The issues Jesus faced are the issues that remain today. The picture of the incarnation is colored in with humility, and that is enough to create an offense. Humility is an offense. The light of Christ within us is the proof that remains in the pudding, if you will. What does the world experience when it experiences you or me? I'm sure that there is such a thing as good fruitcake, but fruitcake can look beautiful until you bite into it and you discover the definition of dry.
I
know. But all the ones that I've had that my mother raved about, it's like, oh, you got to be kidding me. So joy is the fruit of the truth of Christ and the ways of God. C.S. Lewis once said, joy is the serious business of heaven. The fruit of Jesus' work is definite. Those who are thrust to the margins are redeemed and restored. Jesus does that kind of stuff. Therefore, the further I go, the more I learn that joy is the fruit of gratitude. I can't think of a better way to practice joy than to express gratitude to others and to God. And by the way, we get an opportunity all day long to express gratitude. That's pretty.